Penguin Random House Audio presents Rescue Board, the untold story of America's efforts to save the Jews of Europe, by Rebecca Erbelding, read for you by Hilary Huber. Some people say we should not trust our eyes, that there is nothing, just a seeming. These are the ones who have no hope. They think that the moment we turn away, the world, behind our backs, ceases to exist, as if snatched up by the hands of thieves. Czesław Miłosz, from the poem Hope, 1943, published in his 1945 collection O Selenia, Rescue. Prologue. France, August 1942. The buses that took the children away arrived first. The sun beat down, and the loveliness of August in Provence, the olive groves green and gray, the newly harvested wheat fields still golden, stood in stark contrast to the tile factory, a looming brick structure enclosed by barbed wire. Within, more than 1,500 people waited for the end to begin. Nearly 70 children, some just toddlers, were gathered in the factory's dusty courtyard as two large buses pulled up. Their parents did not know where the children would go, only that it would not be to Poland. The Jewish organizations working inside Les Mille, the name of this makeshift concentration camp, had negotiated with the French government to exempt the children from deportation. With the hours growing short before the first train was to leave, the time had come to say goodbye. Grasping tiny faces and stroking hair, mothers and fathers gave frantic goodbye kisses and cried, "Gut sein," be good, before the buses rolled away. Some of the parents screamed and collapsed. Roswell McClelland watched off to the side, pacing and smoking. A 28-year-old Californian, Ross was one of only a few dozen Allied aid workers permitted in the concentration camps, mostly representatives of pacifist churches. He and his wife, Marjorie, both worked for the American Friends Service Committee, AFSC, a Quaker organization. Because the AFSC had fed hundreds of thousands of German children after World War I, the Nazis and their French collaborators allowed them entry into the camps to distribute food and clothing while forcing other Americans out of occupied and collaborationist territory. And now, the AFSC found itself in a position none of the staff ever imagined. Splitting up families, likely forever, in a heartbreaking attempt to save the lives of the children. As he watched the fathers and mothers wail, Ross tried not to get emotional. Though none of the other aid workers knew, Marjorie was pregnant with their first child. What kind of a world, he wondered, separates parents from their children? Other prisoners in Les Mille, also watching the scene, had sent their children out of the camp sooner. Relief workers, including Ross and Marjorie, secreted the kids to orphanages run by the Œuvre de Secours aux Enfants, a children's aid organization. As the war dragged on, some of those children would go into hiding with non-Jewish families. Others would try to sneak over the border to Switzerland or to Spain. And others would be arrested and deported east, like their parents before them. Several hundred children, whose mothers and fathers signed away all parental rights, had already left for America to be placed with new families. A group of 50 children from France had departed nearly 3 months earlier. Their first letters from America would not arrive in time to reach their parents in Les Mille. It was Monday, August 10th, 1942, the beginning of the deportation of foreign Jews from southern France toward Drancy, a transit camp outside Paris. From Drancy, the prisoners would take a long train ride toward an uncertain fate in Nazi-occupied Poland. Ross had his suspicions of what awaited the prisoners of Les Mille. He had just returned to Provence after an emergency trip to Vichy, the capital of Nazi collaborationist France, where he and a group of colleagues had managed to meet with Pierre Laval, the head of the authoritarian government. They implored Laval to cancel the deportations. McClelland impressed upon him that the Germans wanted to exterminate these people. Laval scoffed. The accusation was preposterous, a fiction. The French were assisting the Nazis in removing troublemaking foreign Jews from France, and the prisoners were going to special ethnic reservations in southern Poland, where they could live and work together. Besides, Laval added, if the United States loved the Jews so much, why didn't McClellan's country accept them? In fact, many of the prisoners at Les Mille had been collecting the documentation required to get a visa to the United States. But for most, the bureaucratic obstacles erected by both the American and the Vichy governments, not to mention the challenge and expense of reserving space on one of the few passenger ships still crossing the Atlantic, made immigration impossible. The AFSC's refugee division tried to assist thousands, including a significant percentage of the Les Mille prisoners, with their applications and paperwork. McClelland knew many of them, knew their families, knew how close they were to getting the all-important visas, knew them as individuals in a way bureaucracies couldn't. In the weeks prior to the deportations, Vichy France canceled exit visas for refugees, the last official document a prisoner needed to be released from a camp prior to immigration. As a result, even those who received their U.S. visas could no longer leave. The AFSC protested and got reprieves for a few. But in October 1942, more than 270 letters alerting the recipients their U.S. visas had finally been approved were returned to the Marseille consulate, marked undeliverable. At least 17 of the letters were for prisoners deported from Les Mille in the early morning of August 11th, 1942. After the buses with the children drove away, McClelland and his colleague, Russell Ritchie, left for a few hours, returning in the middle of the afternoon with two prisoners from Hotel Bompard, a Marseille hotel used as a holding center for women waiting for their American visas. Having learned that their husbands would soon be deported from Les Mille, the two women surrendered their children and resolved to join the deportations voluntarily. For the second time that day, Ross walked into a terrible scene in the courtyard. The prisoners were lined up, the 700 who had been at the camp for months, plus 800 whom the Vichy guards had collected from the countryside over the previous week, for a long roll call. The commandant of Les Mille, Robert Molivet, refused to choose the prisoners who would leave first, saving his energy to plead to higher officials for those he felt should be exempted entirely. There was no humane way to go about his work, so he did it alphabetically, A through H. The roll call consumed hours. From Abenstern, Otto, a 38-year-old from Stuttgart, to Hirsch, Hermann, 56, from Berlin. The names were shouted, and 262 prisoners learned, definitively, that they would be going. 18-year-old Richard Greilsamer, the youngest, accompanied his parents. Blondine Weil, aged 80, the oldest, probably volunteered herself to spare someone younger for a few more days, or to stay with her daughter, Pauline Frank. At least six people on the list had almost made it to Cuba in 1939 on the St. Louis, before being turned back and finding temporary safety in France. Ludwig and Irma Bauer from Berlin, their son already in the U.S. Army, would never learn that on the day of their deportation, officials across the ocean in Washington, D.C., finally approved their American immigration visas. Guards in black uniforms.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?